And this is Building Bridges. I'm Mimi Rosenberg with
Ken Nash.
Democracy in Chains, the Deep History of the Radical Right's Stealth Plan for America, with Nancy McLean, author and professor of history and public policy at Duke University. You know, the Janus Supreme Court decision in June and other current struggles over Trump's pick for the Supreme Court vacancy are only the most recent manifestation of the right's decades-long game plan to not only unravel the New Deal of the 1930s and the Civil Rights Revolution of the 1960s, but beyond that, to establish property rights over democratic rights as the basis for our government.
Professor McLean traces this counter-revolution 60-year-old plan. Their agenda is not just to alter specific legislation or court decisions or who gets elected, but to fundamentally alter the rules of democratic governance by voter suppression and gerrymandering, along with instituting constitutional and judicial changes.
And we need to know how we got to this place, because democracy is in chains. Now, let's listen to Nancy McLean, author and professor, who spoke at...
She spoke at a book talk sponsored by the D.C. 37 AFSCME Education Fund Library.
Especially moving to me and angering to me to be here with you, to have you facing the Janus case, which is every bit a part of the cause that I wrote about in this book. This free market fundamentalist cause that we're up against now actually had its first moment when it gained traction and got a following in the South in the late 1950s and early 60s, in the reaction to Brown versus Board of Education's mandate to desegregate public education. But today, to think about what we're facing today and what you're all dealing with in your everyday work, I want to start with this issue of money in politics. And I'm sure a lot of folks in this room are aware of Jane Mayer's research, the brilliant investigative journalist who first alerted us all to the Koch donors, you know, and the investments they're making in our politics. My work is a kind of complement to hers from history. And I happened on the source of the ideas that are guiding the operational strategy that has made that money so devastatingly effective, particularly in the last decade, and now with accelerating velocity in the Trump administration. They alert us to what the real endgame of all of this is, and as my title suggests, is enchaining our democracy. The plan is actually to bind our political process in such a way as to make our institutions incapable of responding to the popular will, at least where it involves taxation and spending. And where the left in recent years has been issue-oriented, campaign-focused, and often siloed, the right has been power-oriented and has been working hard to rig the rules of the game across the board. What we're seeing now is not about one sector. Labor is crucial in all this, but it is not about one sector or one issue or even a bunch of issues added up. And it's far more than partisan. It is an audacious bid, six decades in the making, to fundamentally change the relationship between the government and the people and to make that change permanent. Let me quote the head of Koch Industries' government and public affairs operation, Mark Holden, who in late 2015 gloated to an invitation-only summit of billionaire and multimillionaire donors. And I quote, "We're close to winning. They don't have the real path. It is a plan that moves through control of an ever-growing number of states. At this point, they have what the Democracy Alliance calls an electoral stranglehold over 30 states. And as they control those states, they alter the rules of the game as they go through measures you know well, through undermining the power of public sector unions, through suppressing the vote, through right to work for less laws, through radical redistricting to misrepresent the will of the remaining voters so as to overestimate right-wing voters' will and underplay the rest of the voters, and all the rest. The end game, though, of all of this is a constitutional convention. the first and only such constitutional convention since the Constitution was crafted. And what they want to do is change the Constitution in a manner that would rule out in advance most of what progressive social movements, above all labor in the early years, then civil rights, feminists, environmentalists, everybody else, a way that would rule out in advance what those progressive social movements have accomplished, not just since the 1960s, not just since the 1930s, but since the 1890s. Consider this. While the eyes of most journalists and citizens have been fixed on Washington and lately fixated on Donald Trump, the scores of organizations and elected officials funded by Charles Koch and the donor network he has been built up have been lining up the authorizations needed for this constitutional convention. They now have authorization from 28 of the 34 states needed to call a convention. A ballooning deficit that has been estimated to be $1.5 trillion from the tax scam that just passed, that ballooning deficit could help them get the remaining six. And here's the really scary thing. There are six states in which the GOP controls both houses of the legislature that have not yet authorized a convention. Idaho, Kentucky, Minnesota, Montana, South Carolina, and Virginia. All six of those could line up within the next few years, especially if this tax bill does what's predicted in running up the deficit so extravagantly. Because the first item of business at that constitutional convention, and the one that they know polls well until people understand what it would really do to Social Security, Medicare, and everything else they value, is a balanced budget amendment. Something that the political right has tried and failed repeatedly to get from the normal political process in Congress. We have never had a constitution of the states. All the people who have studied this say that it would necessarily be a runaway convention where everything would be open because there is no way to control the agenda. The delegate at the first constitutional convention in 1787 who urged the inclusion of this state option was George Mason of Virginia. As coincidence would have it, this public university just across the Potomac from Washington, D.C., is the political base camp of the Koch operation. Its economics department lines up the game plans. Its Mercatus Center pushes out policies to Congress and the states and actually trains congressional staff people in these ideas. And its recently renamed Scalia School of Law advances the case for the kind of Gilded Age restoration favored by the Kochs. Charles Koch would tell you that it would be a land of glorious liberty, a place of finally, truly free enterprise, yielding unheard of prosperity. Even, he says, it would bring world peace. But this libertarian utopia would be a frightening dystopia for the rest of us. It would look a lot like America in 1900, a place where workers had no legal right to organize for collective voice and power, a place of massive voter suppression, a place where corporations were all but free of democratic accountability, whether for discrimination or pollution or consumer protection, a place with no Social Security, no Medicare, no Medicaid. But not even the Republican voters who are sticking by Donald Trump would want to live in this world. So how could this Koch-led right carry out this kind of transformation in a democracy? That's really where my research brings something new to the table. The operational strategy that Koch and his team have devised to surmount this obstacle, I found in my research, at George Mason in particular, depends on stealth. It proceeds through a series of what Charles Koch himself calls interrelated plays, mutually reinforcing incremental changes that build on one another in a way that the cause never has to inform the people of the true endgame. Koch and his field generals know that their vision of the good society and the just government will never win majority support. Koch said this in 1997, "Since we are greatly outnumbered, The failure to use our superior technology ensures failure. So what is this superior technology he was calling on others to apply? He found that technology, those ideas, in a body of thought developed by a Virginia-based, little-known, Nobel Prize-winning economist named James McGill Buchanan. Buchanan developed a new school of political economy, sometimes called the Virginia School, sometimes called public choice economics. He was a native Tennessean, and he fused the kind of Southern white conservatism he grew up with there with the libertarian economics that he learned as a PhD student at the University of Chicago. And in 1956, he came to Charlottesville, Virginia. And there, in Charlottesville, as the state of Virginia, in goading the wider South to massive resistance to Brown versus Board of Education, Buchanan was hired as the new chair of the economics department at the state's flagship university. And there in Charlottesville, backed by the state's elite and funded by the leading underwriter of free market fundamentalism of the time, actually the direct forebear to Charles Koch's favorite academic philanthropy, there Buchanan crafted a set of powerful ideas to counter the New Deal and the emerging civil rights movement at their very source. What was then a widespread belief in government and trust that government could remedy market failure for the common good. Buchanan believed this was wrong, and he set out to stop it. First, by building this scholarly theory of how the liberal state developed over the course of the 20th century, and then by designing strategy to reverse engineer that form of government permanently. One of his greatest gifts to the right was this advice. He said, "If you don't like the outcome of politics over the long term, stop thinking about who rules, the particular personalities or even the political parties, and instead think about how to change the rules." Because, he argued, the existing rules produced tax and spend behavior no matter who was in office. And you probably thought that Ronald Reagan did some pretty dramatic things to America and made some pretty dramatic changes that we're still struggling with. What you need to know is that he failed from the perspective of these libertarians. He did not go far enough. They were also frustrated with George W. Bush, and that's why they're doing what they're doing now. Buchanan's next gift to the right was the outline of what he called a new economic constitution, a set of inviolable rules to govern the political economy that would end the transfer of wealth through taxes from unwilling but compelled people he spoke of as productive contributors to those he spoke of as parasites. But here's the thing about this kind of constitution that was talking about. It's already been done. Buchanan was invited to Chile in 1980 under the Pinochet dictatorship to advise them on a new constitution. They called it the Constitution of Liberty, that would allow this brutal dictatorship to maintain the changes they had effected while they had destroyed all the unions, all the farmers groups, all the student groups, the free press, everything else. They privatized Social Security, privatized education, privatized healthcare. They wanted to keep all that, but they knew they had to go back to elected government. Buchanan advised them on a constitution that could help them keep those things in place. That constitution is still in effect now in Chile, and a president who was elected by 2/3 of the Chilean people in 2013, Michelle Bachelet, complained that it was a constitution of locks and bolts, that with that constitution she could not honor her promises to the Chilean people because it prevented her from doing it. That's exactly what Buchanan wanted. Charles Koch noticed this success. In fact, he called on Buchanan for advice on how to promote Social Security privatization beginning in 1983. But then Buchanan became one of the hundreds of libertarian intellectuals that Koch invested in after the late 1960s. And by 1997, Koch had decided that Buchanan's ideas gave him what he needed to effect a radical transformation, one that would go behind the backs of the people, proceeding in increments without telling us about the end game. And so he made his first $10 million gift to Buchanan Center at George Mason, where Koch is now the largest donor. And he made clear in a speech that accompanied that gift just how ambitious and audacious his vision was for this investment. He said, and I quote, "I want to unleash the kind of force that propelled Columbus to his discoveries." We have all felt that force since, as the organizations and elected officials backed by Koch have engaged in a systematic effort at radical rules change across the board in the states and nationally in a plan that has weaponized Buchanan School of Thought and brought us to this current crisis and to Donald Trump in the White House. We've seen this in the transformation of the Republican Party, and we have seen it in the states taking off with a big bang in Wisconsin in 2011 when Scott Walker applied Buchanan's ideas to destroy the power of public sector labor unions. That move was the first of a series of interrelated plays in Wisconsin and the one on which the rest depended. Why? You know the answer. Because unions were the leading source of countervailing power to corporations, because they turned out pro-public sector voters, and not least because unions keep alive values like fairness, sustainability, the dignity of all of us, and solidarity. Before long, after he did that, Walker was trying to end tenure in the state university system, to suppress voting, even to stop state employees from using the phrase climate change, and much more. But arguably, this project of radically rewriting the rules moved furthest in my own state of North Carolina, where we have seen a stunning barrage of rules changes on this model, one after another, from extreme gerrymandering, the most radical gerrymander in our history, to misrepresent the will of the electorate so that the Republicans can choose their voters rather than the voters choosing their officials, new measures to undermine workers' ability to organize in unions, particularly public sector unions, attacks on public education at all levels and radical cuts in funding for it, refusal to accept the Medicaid expansion of the Affordable Care Act despite a crying need for health care in our low-wage state, getting rid of the Racial Justice Act that was designed to ensure fairness in policing and in the courts, rolling back measures to protect the environment and reduce global warming. In all of these things, again and again, this new radicalized GOP broke with customary practices like public hearings before passing significant legislation and transparency about the process. Instead, we saw breakneck speed and secrecy. They actually took rights away from teachers after midnight in one session. And then, to cap it all off, once they had the governorship too, they passed what has come to be known as the Monster Voter Suppression Bill of 2013 to keep people who would oppose this agenda away from the polls. So, AFSCME being a union that is deeply involved in the political process, I think you know how in Washington they have fought progressives on every issue, from immigration reform to the Affordable Care Act to court appointments, environmental regulations, and more. And having won over every single Republican front runner to their agenda in 2016, they created a field so toxic that Donald Trump managed to win the presidency. Lo and behold, the Koch wish list is being granted with epic speed by the Trump administration on everything from labor rights and the environment to the judiciary, healthcare, and taxation. Donald Trump has recently crowed that we have made more progress in the last year than in the previous 10, and more progress in the last 5 years than the previous 50 that he had been investing. But the biggest victory of all would be that constitutional convention, because that would enable the kind of lasting success these guys are seeking across the board. And I believe that that tax bill that the Senate passed, which was as unpopular as their health care bills, sets up those remaining states to topple. I know that's a lot to absorb. But to make our conversation tonight as useful to you as possible, I want to turn now to this all-important question that we're all thinking about, and that is, of course, the proverbial, what is to be done? If we have this Koch battle plan, if we know where this is coming from, if we understand how altering the rules has made it so successful over the last decade, and if we know why the ultimate end game is changing our ultimate rules book, the Constitution, what are the action implications for folks like you who are in daily contest with such determined, and I have to say, ruthless opponents? Obviously, our vision is very different. It's even opposite from theirs, you could say. But I think that we can learn from some of what they have done. And the first thing I would say is that ideas really matter to long-term success. Right now, too, I think knowledge is power. The most valuable finding of my research for people in organizing and in politics is that the Koch-funded right turned to this stealth strategy because they were all too aware that if the majority knew what the real endgame was, they would never get away with it. So I believe that is a huge source of potential strength. It is colossal, right? That majority that is out there, that is latent, that can be informed, that can be activated, that can be organized to deal with this. So I think we should be shouting this from the rooftops, that they are doing this in this way to avoid telling, frankly, even their own voters on who they depend, the truth. So that, I think, is important. I think there's all kinds of organizing that can be done in that vein. Second thing, I think, that comes from this analysis is realizing that the days of silos are over on the left, or should be over. No group can win this alone. On the progressive side, people need to realize that the Koch-backed right is not coming for any particular target, but for all of us. All of us. Every labor union, every civil rights group, every feminist, every environmental organization, every queer group seeking equality, every retirees group is a target. And not just from some atavistic prejudice, as phrases like the war on women might make you think, but for the architects of all of this, it's coming from a coldly calculated reasoning. Because all of us rely on that New Deal, civil rights, great society model of government, of a federal government with the capacity to carry out the will of the people using taxation and regulation. Today's right is coming at the very tools that enabled the great popular successes of the 20th century. From consumer protection to retirement security and labor standards to workplace diversity to equal employment protections, clean air and water, marriage equality, all of this violates their sense of the way things should be. So that while our particular goals may differ and different people, you know, in different constituencies will prioritize particular activities as they should, our need for a responsive government, for a functioning, healthy, renewed democracy unites us. So the work of protecting and expanding our democracy needs to be part of everyone's strategy and practice. Third, the only way to win a struggle like this, and I'm, you know, it will sound, might sound grandiose, but an epochal struggle like this, I believe this as a historian, that's what we're talking about, is by thinking long-term. Is not by thinking about just the next midterms or 2020 or the, you know, two weeks ahead as we so often tend to do in kind of campaign mode, but instead thinking a bit like them. Thinking about where do we want to be a couple decades from now and who else and what else is going to be needed to get there. I believe that progressives can do this kind of thinking. I believe that environmentalists did this when they started realizing that they needed to address environmental injustice and, you know, deal with communities of color and poor communities that were being screwed by corporations. So I think this can be done, but to derail the train that is on the track now so as to enable that better future, I believe that leaders and organizers need to send out the signal that this is an all-hands-on-deck emergency in our society, the likes of which we have not seen in our lifetimes. What the Koch right has set off is a battle for the soul of our country and the salvation of our democracy, and I believe that has to be our starting point. And I'll say something else before wrapping up. We have had experience with moments like this in our history in America because we have a very deep anti-democratic current in our country that comes particularly from the slaveholders of the South and that has gone through a chain of thinking through them. And again, we have been up against this, what I think of now as property supremacy. And we have seen every time there was a pitched battle like this in the 1860s, in the 1930s, and the 1960s, the only way that democracy was saved was by renewing it, by expanding it, by deepening it, by making it more able to deal with the challenges of a particular historical moment. So in the Civil War, the Confederacy was winning. The slaveholders were winning until it became a war of emancipation. When it became a war of emancipation, everything changed and the Union Army started to win. And then we got the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, which have been the basis for so much social reform since. In the 1930s, the property supremacists did not want to do anything about the suffering that people were experiencing as a result of the worst depression in human history. They were only forced to do that by the organizing of workers in the CIO, by the organizing of retirees who wanted protection in their old age, and a slew of other movements in the 30s. And defending democracy required transforming, renewing, and deepening it. So you see where I'm going. I believe that this can be done, but I do not believe as a historian that we will be able to do this if we're just thinking about the next Democrats to get in office in the next election cycle. It's got to be much deeper than that, much more thoroughgoing to deal with all the challenges and the problems and the frustrations that have been building up over decades now. So I do believe it can be done. You guys, I know, are at the center of the storm with this Janus case coming down. How do we begin to lay the road to that future by thinking long-term, given the very real and pressing need to play defense in the face of these escalating attacks? Think about that. You know, you guys are dealing with this, so how do you deal with trying to save what the work of generations and decades has built up, but also do it in a way that isn't just defensive, right? That opens out to where we need to go.
And we want to thank Nancy McLean, author and professor of history and public policy at Duke University, for her presentation, and urge you to get the book. It's really important. Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right's Stealth Plan for America. This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.